Jerry Bergman, and he's going to be talking on a survey of how the subject of origins is taught, and you're a professor of biology at Northwestern?
Northwest State. Medical school in Cleveland. Is it on now?
You're on.
I'm on now. Okay. What I did is I'm trying to find out how many or most teachers, college and high school, teach the subject of origins, biological origins. And there hasn't been a lot of research on this. There's a lot of opinions on what should be taught, but there's not a lot of research on what in fact is taught. And so what I thought I would do is just primarily ask high school teachers as well as professors, surveyed by telephone as well as in person, and just basically ask them controversial subjects like origins, biological origins. How do you teach it? You know, what do you say? What's your approach? And I wanted it to be not a questionnaire where they had to answer A, B, C, or D, but somewhat non-directive so we could just talk about what they did. And I tried to set them at ease. I did mention in quite a few cases I was doing a survey, but in many cases I didn't because I feel that would affect my results. So this is kind of a preliminary survey. There really needs to be more research done along this area so people understand indeed what in fact is taught. And I also sat in on several classes. I went to a number of schools, about five schools, and I asked if I could sit in on classes, and I did so. And a number of times I sat in on classes where they were talking about evolution. Okay, one of the most common, about 80% of the subjects that I talked to said that, as we talked about just a few minutes ago, religion and science were separate disciplines and they had different answers to the subject of origins. And typically they said science is fact, religion is faith, or they would say science explains how, religion explains who. That was a common response. And I felt in talking to them that they're really saying this to get out of problems. It's a way of neutralizing, well, I'm not really against religion, but we're going to talk about science, and this is how we got here. When I talked to students got a pretty strong impression that he was saying that Darwinism, evolution, Neo-Darwin, whatever term you want to use, and that was a problem, by the way. I really needed to define evolution. And I tried to. I asked them, how do you define evolution? And the evolution definition that most people use is, or at least the orthodox scientists, is from the goo to you by way of the zoo, or more kindly put, from molecules to man. Okay, so when I cover this in my classes, I always give them some definitions. That's a big problem. Many articles that I read that talk about evolution don't define the term. So it's hard for me to know what they're talking about, although usually the molecules to man is what they're referring to. And what about teachers who themselves were creationists? My survey, about 20% were creationists, and there's been, ironically, a fair number of surveys done on how many high school teachers and college teachers are creationists. And high school teachers, about 20 to 40% are creationists, according to the studies. More in the south, less in the north, less in the east. California seems to be in the middle, west at least in the middle. How do they cover the material? A lot were fearful. Okay, they really wanted to avoid it. And a common response was simply, you include it at the end of the course and, gee, we just haven't gotten to this. And I talked to a number of students, quite a few students, more actually than faculty, because I have about 100 students every semester I teach. And a lot of them said, well, you know, we never got to it. Now, of course, I didn't know why, because I'm talking to students, but a common way is just to avoid it. And part of it is, when I talk to teachers, is that they didn't want to get in trouble. and they felt they could. So the best thing is to avoid it. And that conjuncts a lot of research I'm doing in the area of teachers who do get into trouble. And you may have noticed in the bookstore here, I have a book called Slaughter of the Dissidents, in which I documented hundreds of cases of mostly college, but also many high school teachers who have been let go because of, in many cases, suspicion that they were teaching creation. Now, what teaching creation is rarely defined. You know, what do you mean by teaching creation? And when I did research for the book, a lot of people define teaching creation as criticizing evolution. So saying negative things about evolution. For example, one teacher used a bunch of articles from Science and other peer referee journals which talked about the problems of Haeckel's embryos. There's an article in Science, about 6-7 years ago, I guess, and he used that article in his class. Well, that was defined as teaching creationism, and he got into trouble. And so, for good reason, a lot of teachers simply avoid talking about what they believe. Others say things like, well, I have to teach evolution. I don't believe it, but I have to teach it, so here we go. And that was more common than I thought. And I'm not aware of any teachers who got in trouble for doing that, but that's one way of getting around it. One thing that bothers me is that a lot of students get a misconception about where teachers are at. And teachers feel fearful about this whole subject. I'm working on a chapter now for one of my latest books on Slaughter of the Dissidents. It's going to be 5 volumes. It's volume 1 is out. Volume 2 will be out this month. Volume 3, we're close to being finished. So there are thousands of cases. I have 4 file cabinets full of documentation. But a case I'm working on now, the John Freshwater case from Ohio, and he was fired openly because he had a Bible on his desk. In fact, there's a whole website titled Bible on the Desk. He taught for 20-some years. And by the way, one of the Bible he had on his desk was checked out from the school library. And the testimony is 4 times as long as the O.J. Simpson trial. And we're talking about a Bible on a desk. And it struck me as I read almost 2,000 pages of testimony where they're talking about Bibles here, Bibles there. Is there a Bible in the library? Do other faculty have Bibles on their desk? And the interesting thing about this case was, even though the Bible was on his desk, he was kind of an absent-minded chemistry, biology teacher, and most teachers didn't know it was there because they couldn't see it because there's lots of junk on his desk. And I guess he actually had his personal Bible there too, but nobody's, you know, the testimony was in detail as to which Bible it was and where it was and when they saw it, and I thought about, gee, on and on and on about Bibles. But, of course, that's not the only thing. They were suspicious that he taught not creation but information that would cause students to doubt Orthodox Darwinism. And most of that was hearsay. And frankly, after reading 2,000 pages of Bibles on desks and such, after a while, it's hard to read it. But you can see why some teachers are fearful, because after he got in trouble for having a Bible on his desk, and by the way, that's part of his write-up, which they used in order to fire him. They did a report on why they should terminate him. And the rest of the teachers, boy, they scoured their rooms, and anything that had any religious implications at all was removed. And a number of teachers said, yeah, I searched the room, and I found a book on Jesus in the book, and I got in the classroom, and I got it out of there. So they really censored everything that had to do with religion from their classrooms. Okay, teachers who are evolutionists, some of these even experience problems. Primarily parent and student complaints, primarily at the high school level, of course. And I talked to a number of these teachers, and one said, no matter how carefully you teach it, you're going to have complaints. You just kind of expect it. And sometimes the complaints are pretty major. sometimes they're not. And one approach that teachers who are evolutionists use as well as to just skip the evolution topic. I had quite a few teachers say, you know, I'm an evolutionist. I believe that's how we got here, but it's not worth it. Just skip it. Just don't cover it. Because invariably I'm going to have some fundamentalist kid complain, and it's not worth it. So I'll just skip it. So as a result, what I find is that a lot of teachers just don't cover it. Another approach was to state that evolution is the means that God used to create. Therefore, there's no conflict. And many told me that the reason they said this was to just reduce problems. But rarely, I found, did they explain what role God had in evolution. God did it, and this is how, and that's the last time God is mentioned. So they use it as a way of trying to avoid dealing with problems. Science is fact, religion is morals. I can talk here. That was common as well. And another approach, which was probably about 15% of my sample, is that the teacher said evolution is fact, theological explanations are faith, and only fact will be covered in their science class. And some went beyond that, and no small number said basically religion is not true, it's false, and it's irrelevant, and therefore we're going to be covering only science. And then a fourth approach, which I found was least common, but both students and the teachers I talked to were most positive about this approach. In fact, one professor in Indiana, this is what he taught. He taught creationism, intelligent design, theistic evolution, naturalistic evolution, panspermia, and he taught myths from other cultures. So he talked about the Indian myth. Pardon? University college level. And I asked a number of students how they felt about this, and they gained an appreciation for some of the myths, which some people feel are very foolish. And many never heard of panspermia. Many heard of creation ID, but didn't really know the difference. And so they felt, whether they accept it or not, at least they know what creationism is. At least they know what ID is.
Say some of them developed an appreciation for other cultures rather than ID or the other more
credible ones. Yeah, they felt more positive about some of these myths. Now, I'm not sure which ones he went over, but he went over several other creation myths.
Yeah.
And people felt that they found that interesting because it covered material which was not scientific but helped them appreciate how science impacts other cultures and how science is interacts with and is interconnected with other cultures.
Were you able to differentiate whether some of these so-called survey courses actually tended to favor one or the other in the instruction?
Well, this particular one here that I'm referring to, a couple of people did this, and they clearly favored evolution. In fact, this professor from Indiana said, I'm an evolutionist, but you ought to be aware of the others. And so the class knew where he was coming from, but nonetheless, they felt he did a fairly good job in explaining respectfully what these views are. And he also let them know that indeed, if they accept one of the other views, that's okay. How I do it, by the way, you might be curious. What I do is I mention to students that, because I teach biology, and we have several units on evolution, I say, we'll cover evolution. We're not worried about what you believe. Whether you accept evolution or not is up to you. But if you reject it, you at least ought to understand what evolution is. You know, we do cover it, but I'm respectful if you don't go along with it. In fact, I've done surveys of my faculty at the college where I teach, Northwest State, and found about half of the professors are creationists, more traditional creationists, young earth, old earth, and about 80% of the faculty are either creationists or intelligent design supporters. Of the science faculty, it's about 50% were evolutionists and 50% were either ID or supporters of creationism. So among the science faculty, it's split pretty much down the middle. And we also did surveys among students. We found about 90% of our students are creationists of some type. Now, this is a state college, and the focus of the college is a science area. We have a lot of engineering majors, plastic majors, ecology majors, nursing, health science area. So science is a major focus of the college. I would say probably half of our students are in some way connected to some science, engineering, math area. So it's a pretty strong area. But it's in a conservative part of the state. And so therefore, when I give that information to the students, I think they don't feel alone that I'm attacking them or the school's attacking them, when they realize that 90% of their students are in the same belief structure that I am. I think that helps them be more comfortable with the class because it is a high number. So I find that helpful. And I also did a survey at Bowling Green State University on where the biology students were at on this issue, and less were creationists, but a significant number were creationists. And we surveyed, I must have been 200 students in the biology courses at Bowling Green State University. And that was published in a magazine called Origins, which is a Seventh-day Adventist publication. Okay, this summarizes the last approach I mentioned. One way is to teach that science has proven life originated by natural means and then falsifies theological explanations. Therefore, theological explanations are wrong. And a number of professors stressed that evolution from molecules to humans was fact, and if you disagree, you must accept this view or you'll fail the class. And that was more common than you might think, but it was, I thought, about 15% had this approach. University of Toledo, one specific example, first day of class, he told them that molecules to man evolution was true, and if they disagreed, they should drop the class immediately, and several students walked out on the spot. So he was pretty blunt on where he was at. And I got this not from the professor, but from students. So students related this to me. Okay, a few case histories. This is one example which illustrates a problem that I saw. To be certified to teach biology in Ohio at the high school level, you don't have to take a single course in evolution. And I called almost all the universities asking the requirements for a degree in biology, and none of them, including Ohio State, did not require a single course in evolution. So I found that most didn't know much about evolution. Many knew it was true, and creationism and ID was wrong, but they didn't know a lot about evolution. And one class in particular, which I sat in, and I talked to a number of people, and they said, yeah, this is typical, is... The professor said, life evolved from methane, ammonia, carbon dioxide, water, and other common simple compounds. Lightning or some other energy source formed amino acids and other macromolecules. These were able to reproduce and assemble together, forming cell-like structures, and natural selection then took it from there, and here we are. And a student asked, has this been proven scientifically? And the professor said, oh, yes, we have evidence for each step. This is how we got here. Of course, referring to Stanley Miller's 1953 experiment. And I thought, gee, this is interesting. As you know, if you studied that, in fact, Stanley Miller, before he died, realized that he didn't make any progress beyond his original 1953 experiment. He spent his whole life trying to figure out how life could evolve. And I remember one comment he made, which was really intriguing. He says, you know, I haven't moved at all beyond where I did in 1953. But we'll get the answer someday. And when we do, it'll be simpler than we think. And we'll say, ah, why didn't I think of that? So he was confident eventually we would be able to figure out how we can take ammonia and methane and water and some other compounds and from that get life. And this teacher evidently didn't have a clue that indeed that's has not been very helpful in abiogenesis. And she led the students to believe that indeed this is all fact, that we can indeed get life in the laboratory. And another professor said, once the cell evolved, soon simple organisms such as yeast formed. Of course, I remember I presented, in fact, I think an ASA conference, and I made the mistake of linking the word bacteria and simple together. And this microbiologist said, simple, bacteria? You don't know much about bacteria, do you, Bergman? Well, I have had a couple courses, and it's not simple. So yeast, of course, is not even a prokaryote as bacteria is. So yeast is far more complex than bacteria. One of the professors I had at the medical school, he was an expert in yeast. And I asked him if I could tell the difference, basically by looking at external morphological traits of the cell, between yeast and a human cell. And he said, well, an expert can, but you probably can't. And I said, well, what is the difference? He said, well, it's be long to explain, but most people could not look at a yeast cell and a human cell and tell the difference very rapidly. You have to know something about the difference to tell the two apart. But anyways, yeast then evolved into worms, and the worms evolved into fish, the fish and amphibians, amphibians to reptiles, reptiles to mammals, mammals to primates, and last, the apex of evolution, primates, and then, of course, eventually humans. And again, some student asked, do we have the fossil evidence to prove this? Do we have all the evidence necessary to make this generalization? She said, oh, yeah, no problem. Fossil record is very complete. We know all these steps have been very well documented, and it's just a matter of looking at the evidence, which is there, and there's no question that this is how we got here. And I spent a fair amount of time looking at the fossil record, and it's very clear. The first fish is a fish. The first turtle is a turtle. The first dinosaur is a dinosaur. The first amphibian is an amphibian. And I look for even possible, you know, theoretical transitional forms. And the problem was I found many and much discussion on which one is more plausible. There's a lot of disagreement. For example, fish evolution. One expert would say, nope, through this line. Somebody would say, nope, that's wrong for these nine reasons. It's through this line. Well, worms to fish, but how it got from worms to fish, the intermediate stages are enormously debated. So from my own research, since I've done quite a bit of research on this for the past 20 years, this scenario that she painted is just simply speculative. And yet she taught this as fact. One student in one class asked, did God have any role? And she said, nope. Is the science class not religion? God had no role. And the student said, if this is how humans got here, why are there still worms, fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, and primates? Why did they not all evolve? And the professor said, it seems you have been reading creation's books, and this argument has been answered by science, and she basically put him down. And we don't have time. This subject is complex, and I'm not a paleontologist. My research is under Sofala. I would suggest you read creation and intelligent design books, not read creation and intelligent design books, as they only confuse you, which the student felt he was being put down. And this is one problem I found a lot. Students felt, at least, that when they questioned professors in this area, they were all too often put down. And it'd be good to collect some numerical data on this to find out specifically, you know, what percent. But in my experience, it was common. And a result of this was, and I spent, I bet, an hour talking about this with Michael Roos. And I said, it's a problem. You have to allow students to be able to make comments. As they say, the only stupid question is the one you didn't ask. And many, many students I talked to said, nope, I'm not going to ask anything about this because I don't want to be put down. I don't want it to affect my grade. And so this area is difficult for both professors and for students. Okay, what determines what's taught in the classrooms? State standards, district standards, curriculum, textbooks, administration, teacher, him or herself. All of these are important in what is taught. And I have a lot of nasty comments that I've recorded. So, and I'll just go through a couple. Seventh grade teacher, taught the world is created by evolution, time, chance, mutation, lots of luck. I raised my hand. Before I could say anything, he informed us that he would teach only his theory because mine had no basis in fact. And he said he did not want to hear any Christian ideas because they were bogus. I was shocked and angry at our school. He would not even discuss if intelligent design was possible because it was religion. And that's a student actually wrote this out for me and they gave it to me. And I have a whole bunch of these, so I won't go through these. Where are we at on time? Close to 3:30. Oh, court cases quickly. And I call the group Darwin Doubters because when I define evolution, I'm talking about from the goo to you. So theistic evolutionists really would be Darwin Doubters. Okay? Because we're talking about naturalistic evolution. And I spent a lot of time looking at the court cases. There's one case that Darwin Doubters won. In Minnesota, Judge Alderman ruled the library cannot restrict speech about creationism in a public forum. This is a 2000 case. So if you want to talk about creation, intelligent design, etc., in a library, at least in Minnesota, you can. That's the only case that was won. The other side, there are lots of cases, Moore versus Gaston Board of Education. Moore taught Darwinism was true. Adam and Eve's story was false. There's no life after death, no heaven or hell. And the court ruled students have a right to hear all points of view, including this one. And so the court ruled against the school and in favor of Moore and said he could pretty much say whatever he wanted to against a theistic worldview. And a conclusion of all these cases I looked at is that consistently clear from the court cases that can teach against Christianity, the Bible, creationism, intelligent design, and so on, but you cannot teach in favor of it. And again, the court cases are very consistent. One exception, the James Corbett case, judge ruled that Corbett could teach this is a quote because some student recorded his lectures, when you put your Jesus glasses on, you can't see the truth. And then he quoted quoted Mark Twain, religion was invented when the first con man met the first fool. It's a high school history class, by the way. And he said that science searches for rational answers, religion stops inquiring in favor of magic. And he also said the Boy Scouts are a homophobic, racist organization, and the student was a member of the Boy Scouts, and he didn't appreciate that. And the court ruled in favor of this teacher, except the teacher said creationism is superstitious nonsense, and the court ruled this and only this violated the First Amendment. So that's the only case that, and I don't know what they mean by creationism, but that's the only case that you can say the, quote, creationist won, although I think the person involved here was an intelligent design supporter. And that was in the Capistrano United School District in California just a short time ago. Oh, he also taught there's a negative correlation between crime and religion. Sweden has a low level of religious church attendance, high rate of crime. Sweden has a low level of religious involvement and a low level of crime. America has a high level of religious involvement and a high level of crime. And he basically taught that religion causes people to commit crimes. And if you were at the session the other day where we had a criminologist talking about this, he found, using empirical research, that there is a strong negative correlation between religious involvement and involvement in crime. So, comments? Questions?
I think I was in that same session, and what he found was there were
no growth. No, religion and crime, yeah. There's a negative correlation.
No,
juvenile delinquency. Yeah. Yeah, there were some other statistics he cited which were not consistent, but...
Was it rather mixed reaction in the Christian community over the Dover, Pennsylvania court case that ruled against the school board requiring teachers to read a statement that suggested intelligent design as an alternative? A lot of Christians feel like... that perhaps there was no reason for the school board to be doing that. And I kind of wanted to know your take. A lot of these court cases were not clear cut. And since the Christian community is kind of divided on their response to that, I wanted to know how you saw that.
Yeah, I read the whole transcript. It's enormous. And I was appalled. The judge basically plagiarized his decision from the ACLU brief. And there was an enormous amount of misinformation. And in my school, we have a course called Philosophy, and the book we use is called 20 Questions. And inside there is a chapter by Duane Gish, a chapter by Michael Ruse, etc. And we're requiring students in this course to read Duane Gish's, who is a creationist, and yet the Dover School Board was only telling them that in the library is a book which talks about The Other Side, which is Pandas and People, written by a Stanford PhD who actually is in favor of intelligent design, and told them they could read this book if they wanted to, and of course there was a $2 million court case over that. So in my school, we require students in philosophy to read articles by Dwayne Gish. And I'm just thinking, clearly it's unconstitutional what we ask students to do, number one. And that book is like in the 9th edition, 20 questions, the title of it. And it's used throughout the country, and I'm not aware of any single court cases, which I find intriguing.
A lot of the things that you all are asking about will be pertinent after the next presentation, so I don't mean to cut that off, but this has been a great privilege.